Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. From child welfare to truancy to how the criminal justice system handles prostitution, social work intersects with the law in many ways. And it's these intersections that intrigue Dr. Corey Shadema. She wonders how practitioners and the people who are the target of policies respond to programs that they view as unjust or ineffective. Today on the program, she's joining us to talk about social work as a profession of social justice and how to put those values into practice. Dr. Corey Shadema is an assistant professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. She has degrees in law and social work, as I mentioned. Her articles have been published in the Journal of Teaching in Social Work, the British Journal of Social Work, and other publications. Her books include Public Interest Lawyering, The Practice and Pursuit of Social Justice, and Dr. Shadema is in Salt Lake City to deliver the lecture, Storying the Social Justice Profession, Tales from the Field. That's happening tonight at the University of Utah College of Social Work. We'll give you details on that as we go. But Dr. Shadema, thank you so much for your time and welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'll turn on your right microphone. There you go. Later on in the program, the acclaimed artist Nancy Holt will join us to talk about land art and sun tunnels and perspective. But first, social justice. How do you think the criminal justice system or child welfare programs can be improved? And what programs do you think are working? You can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Dr. Shadema, you are in Salt Lake City to argue that social workers should embrace and promote this idea as a profession of social justice. Before we get into the specifics of your research, define for us just what social justice means to you.
Okay, so that's a good question. I would say that there is no one definition of it, that part of, you know, that's going to look different to different people. But drawing on the Social Work Code of Ethics, for example, what we're really looking at is fairness, equity, making sure that people have the chance to do and become, you know, what they have the potential to be, and listening to people about what it is they believe makes a more socially just world. So part of social justice is being open to other people's understanding of what they would like to see for themselves and their communities.
The idea that underpins much of your work is how people cope with policies that don't work for them. So there are a lot of ideas out there, programs, good intentions, and yet for the people on the ground, they don't work in some way. Can you elaborate on this idea of, you know, trying to negotiate a system?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So all of my work involves looking at policies that, you know, someone thought was a good idea, generally sitting from somewhere up above. And those are not always the people that are either implementing the policy or who are the targets of that policy. So looking, for example, at the prostitution diversion programs that I've been looking at, right, you have a group of people coming together saying we have an existing policy, which is in almost all the states in this country. We're arresting people, we're putting them in jail, or we're fining them for engaging in prostitution. And most of the people on the front lines are finding that it doesn't really work. It doesn't deter people. It doesn't really remove the reasons for their engagement in prostitution in the first place. But most of those people, whether they're judges or police officers or probation officers or the women or men or transgender folk themselves who are engaged in prostitution, you know, they don't really see it working. But they're often not consulted about, well, what is it that we could do? What would make it so that I don't want to be doing this anymore?
So there's definitely some good intentions there, but that's not enough.
Right. And so something like a prostitution diversion program, you know, those people on the ground are saying, you know, I can't change the law right now, but is there something I could do within the existing system that would make a difference? Right. And so what you have are in these programs, two programs that I'm looking at in particular. So people are still being arrested and entering the criminal justice system. But the people who have the power to make some small changes on the ground are trying to route them through a different process. So rather than arresting arresting them and throwing them in jail. They're saying, okay, can I meet with you? Can you tell me, you know, what is it that you would like to see? What is it that we can change? Programs are generally individualized. They're long-term, and they're designed to address whatever needs or whatever impetus someone has for engaging in prostitution in the first place. There's, of course, the carrot, you know, that and if you do go into this program, then we might remove the charges. So there's another example of a policy that doesn't work, right? So not only does it not usually work to arrest somebody or throw them in jail, they have collateral consequences that make it even less likely after their trajectory through the criminal justice process that they're going to be able to find legal employment when they get out, right? So it removes that. So it makes it so there are more opportunities, hopefully.
I want to talk about some of the specific programs, including the prostitution research you've been doing and the programs in child welfare. But, I mean, what got you started on this path? What got you thinking about these issues and implementing theory?
I had been a practicing lawyer, so I was kind of out there, and I liked engaging with individuals, sort of talking to them. And I saw a lot of lawyering as manipulating around laws that either do or don't work. And successful lawyers are helpful in making the law work for the people that they work with. So I always saw law as a powerful tool. And I always liked the part of it where you sort of strategize with that person who's sitting next to you and think, okay, what can I do to make this better? Mm. Whatever the thing is that you're trying to fight or change or make work for you.
Mm-hmm. How did you make that transition into social work?
So I had been very interested in, I guess, sort of nonprofit kind of stuff. I started working with a legal services organization, and I was interested in that particular kind of work. And I was also, I always liked school. I went back, I wanted to study, and I had my daughter who's now almost 17, and so it was an opportunity for me to transition. And so I went in trying to look at questions about, you know, relationships, how do people work together, and then the social justice aspects that always kind of drew me. I'm not sure if that's the best answer to your question, but I think as I each step moved me a little bit more forward, I went back to school and I did a master's in law. And during that year that I was doing that, I met with people and I said, okay, this is what I'm interested in. I'm interested in relationships. I'm interested in the connection between social justice and how people use the law to achieve this. When I was looking into programs and thinking, okay, do I go to political science? Do I go to, I didn't really know where there was going to be a disciplinary home for my questions. And one of my mentors at the University of Pennsylvania, a professor by the name of Howard Lesnick, said, have you thought about social work? He had about 25 years before helped to start a law and social policy program at Bryn Mawr School of Social Work, which is where I ended up doing my PhD, and I hadn't really. And when I looked into social work, what excited me about social work were two things. One is it drew on a lot of different methods. That the methods, your research methods were always in the service of the larger goal, and you didn't have to pick a method. You could do qualitative research, you could do quantitative research, but it should be driven by the questions that you're asking and what you're interested in. And I could be eclectic, both in my methods and in my theories, and I like that. I didn't want to be pigeonholed. And the other thing that I loved about social work, it was okay to be passionate about your causes and still be a good academic. And that appealed to me. I wasn't making a career change at the age of 35, to not care about the things that I was going to do. And social work, that was okay. And I still think for the most part it's okay. And I found my way to social work and fell in love and stayed there.
Dr. Corey Shadavis, she's an assistant professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and she's delivering the lecture tonight, Storying the Social Justice Profession, Tales from the Field. That's happening tonight, Thursday, October 18th, 6 to 8 p.m. at the University of Utah College of Social Work here in Salt Lake City. You can find out more information at 801-581-8455, or you can follow some links on our website, kcpw.org. If you'd like to join us, if you've got questions about social justice or programs that work or things that need to be tweaked, call us. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Dr. Shadema, you've been working on a body of work about prostitutes in Baltimore and before and Philadelphia. And before we came on the air, you said you don't want to label people who work in this industry as prostitutes. What is the preferred term, and what's wrong with the term prostitutes?
Yeah, whenever I'm doing work, I try and think about how people think of themselves, right? So one of the things around qualitative research that's most important is you're trying to understand the person from their own perspective. So the people that I talk to, for the most part, don't see themselves as prostitutes. They see prostitution as something that they do.
So it's
not
a job.
Right. So it, not who they are. It's something that they do. And so they would prefer not to be labeled as prostitutes. And on the other hand, and I should actually mention that the people that I speak to who are the people who are almost always arrested for prostitution, we do every once in a while hear about people who are in sort of more high-level prostitution being arrested. But these are mostly people who are engaged in street-level survival prostitution. By survival prostitution, I mean that they're engaging in prostitution in order to meet their most basic needs, whether that's shelter, whether that's food for themselves or for their children, or whether that's feeding an addiction that they have. But they're very basic needs, and they are engaging in prostitution for the most part not as a choice. It is a choice, but it's a choice among very limited choices. So if they had their druthers, if they had other means to make the money in order to meet their needs, they would be doing so. Now, some of them actually do say, again, so the choice, there are some choices, but they feel that they're limited. So some of them, I've had people say to me, what would you prefer, that I were selling drugs to somebody or stealing? Right. So there is a moral, for some, there is a moral ethic. I'd rather do something. I'd rather open myself up to harm than harm somebody else. Right. But for the most part, it's either it's the only choice or a choice among extremely limited alternatives. And I also don't use the term sex work. So while I think that's a fine term, it doesn't really apply to the people that they don't take that on as a term. So they don't view this as something that's empowering. They don't view it as something, you know, they're not looking for worker rights or things like that. I do believe that there are people who are engaged in this work that are, so I'm not belittling that position at all. But it's not something that really speaks to the people that I talk to. And I'm always, you know, and I always try and use the terminology that people use about themselves.
Okay, so we're not going to call people prostitutes. We're going to call people who engage in prostitution.
It's a little cumbersome, but,
you know, it's now that we've got that clarification out of the way, why target this population? I mean, what were you looking for?
Well, I was brought into the program in Baltimore. There were a number of community groups in the city of Baltimore. There is from three specific neighborhoods where there is a lot of prostitution activity. They had gone to the state's attorney's office and they said, you know, I know you guys are doing your job, but whatever it is, it's not working. We see this, you know, the same people out there, and we're sick of the condoms on the streets and the syringes on the streets. You know, can you do something? And so they had all pulled together, and the University of Maryland School of Law and school social work were kind of pulled into this. And I hadn't really been aware so much of this population or of this topic, but I had looked at other instances, you know, before of where there are policies that wasn't working. And they said, you know, will you join? And I thought it was a it was a particularly rich instance of a policy that wasn't working, because everybody, people that you would normally think of adversarial, were in agreement. So normally you might have a defense attorney saying this doesn't work and the prosecutor saying it's no problem.
Sure.
Right? But for this, one of the things that was so interesting is that really I couldn't find anybody who thought it was working. And so that to me was fascinating. Mm. You know, why do we have a policy that nobody thinks works? You know, so it really showed, I guess, a big disconnect between what happens at a political or a policy making level and what actually happens on the ground. And I also found the stories of it's primarily women in the program I'm looking at in Philadelphia is all women. And in Baltimore, it's not gender specific. It's about 89% women and 10% transgender and 1% male. So I just find the stories very compelling. And I think a lot of people think, oh, it's so tragic, it's so sad. These people have had
horrible lives. And I think a lot of them have had a lot of horrible experiences, but they're strong and they're funny and they're interesting and they support each other. And I've also just really enjoyed, you know, you're not out there for 15 years if you're not very strong. So I've also seen a lot of the people I talk to is very strong and resilient and they're inspirational. And I find it really compelling to talk to them.
Mm. We're speaking with Dr. Corey Shadema. She's an assistant professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. We've been talking about some of her research into people who work in prostitution, what's working in the system and what's not. If you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to Rob, who's calling from Salt Lake City. Rob, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, you know, all this money we're spending on social programs and stuff, I mean, why don't we think outside the box and maybe just legalize it? Like, you know, I think it's legal in Nevada, isn't it? In the state of Nevada?
Yeah, in the state of Nevada, Nevada leaves it up to the individual counties to decide on the legality of prostitution. And there are 13 different counties in Nevada that have, you know, different ways that they're handling it, mostly through, you know, forms of registration. But all of the other states and the other Nevada counties, it is illegal. But Rob, I think you bring up a really excellent point. You know, I think from my research, I really see that we should be asking ourselves those kind of questions. You know, why are we perpetuating policies that don't work? I think the prostitution diversion programs are important. I support them. You know, on the other hand, they maybe wouldn't need to exist if we would make some other changes in our policies. So I think we should be looking at that. The question for me, though, is when you have people working on the ground, when you have a police officer that it is his or her job to arrest somebody, what do you do in the meanwhile, right? What do you do in the meanwhile where there isn't the political will or people don't think it's a good idea to change? How do you help people while you're waiting to make those bigger changes? And that's one of the things that I also find really compelling. Mm. So I completely agree with you. I think we should be looking at other options. And this, in part, is what we do while we don't have other options.
Oh, it looks like Rob just left us. Rob, thanks very much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Rob, you know, exploring this idea of legalizing prostitution, what about the victims of prostitution? And I guess that's where it gets a little complicated, right? I mean, when you talk about social justice and having a society where human dignity is valued above all, prostitution doesn't seem to really fit that in that paradigm.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess there's a lot of ways to think about, you know, who I'm listening to you think about, okay, so who are the victims? And there are many potential victims, and not everybody agrees on who the victims are or whether people are victimized. So, you know, in the first place, you know, I'm a mom. I live in a neighborhood. So the community groups that went to the state's attorney's office in Baltimore, I mean, I certainly could see them as victims, right? They have a neighborhood, and they're seeing things. Their daughters are being solicited, you know, their neighborhoods feel unsafe. And so I think it's reasonable for them to have this discussion and say, look, we're having a problem with this in our neighborhood. And I do think that we can see them, you know, as victims. You know, on the other hand, a lot of the you know, the people that I talk to, it's hard for me to think of, you know, the women engaged in street level prostitution or the men or the transgender folks also not being as victims. If you look at the research, the levels of violence are really incredible. And so you have they're exposing themselves to violence and to danger on a regular basis. They're out in the elements. We don't talk about that so much. They're out in the freezing cold. They're out in the rain. You know, the women that I see, you know, they're exchanging information about that. And so I really do think that and making prostitution illegal actually often makes it or moving it out of neighborhoods makes it even more dangerous. Right. So if people are sweeping the streets, where are people going? They're going where nobody, there is nobody. So if you scream, does anybody hear you? If somebody drops you off on the roadside. So I think we definitely could see that there are victims here as well, and we have to really think about that. On the other hand, I am hesitant to say, and there is a feminist critique, that, you know, any form of prostitution is a victimization. I think that there are sex workers who are writing about their own work and speaking about their own work and not viewing it that way.
So, it's complicated. Yes. Dr. Corey Shadema, she's an assistant professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. She's speaking tonight, Storying the Social Justice Profession, Tales from the Field. That's happening Thursday, October 18th, 6 to 8 p.m. at the University of Utah College of Social Work. More information at 801-581 8455. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you work in the courts or if you've worked your way through the system yourself, what works and what doesn't? We'd love to hear your perspectives. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. With degrees in both law and social work, Dr. Corey Shadema's work is part first-person intervention and part big-picture policy, but it's all grounded by a sense of social justice, this idea that society should be based on human rights, dignity, and empowerment. Today on the program, we're talking with Shadema about how her experiences on the front lines have informed her on the policy side. Dr. Corey Shadema is an associate professor. Just got a promotion there. Congratulations. Associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. And again, she's speaking at the University of Utah's College of Social Work tonight at 6 o'clock. We'll give you details on that as we go. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you've got questions about using social justice principles as a guiding star in your practice, or if you are part of this of the system as a client, share your thoughts. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We've been talking about your research into people who engage in prostitution, how the system can better serve them. After extensive interviews with many prostitutes, many judges, many lawyers, many social workers, I mean, where did you come down? Where do you think things can be fixed?
I actually think that when people get into the criminal justice system, it's you know, pretty far down the road. And what I would really like to see are the kind of interventions that might prevent that from happening in the first place. I mean, even some of the people, the professionals in the system that I talk to, you know, say, I'd like to be doing this work elsewhere. You know, this is where I have to do it now. But so I'd like to see more affordable housing. I'd like to see, you know, better mental health services available for people, better drug treatment, you know, earlier interventions. People should not have to be arrested in order to access the kind of help, the wonderful help that's being provided for them. But it's only being provided once they're arrested and charged. So I would really like to see the changes happening much earlier. And I think if that would go a long way to really helping and maybe preventing some of the things that I, you know, that I've seen.
You've also been working in the child welfare arena, doing some work specifically targeting housing in Philadelphia. What was the premise of this research?
Well, I had done some early research for my Negotiating Justice book, and I had interviewed legal services and clients in a number of practice areas, and I was just really struck by the lawyers and clients that I had interviewed who had had their children removed from them because of allegations of child abuse and neglect. And then I had done a housing research project, and when I went back, and it's sort of like when you put those like rose-colored glasses over your eyes and everything looks pink. You know, when I started learning about housing, I was like, oh my, it sort of opened this. I saw housing everywhere. And I went back and I looked at those interviews, and I saw that housing seemed to be a very big part of the troubles that people were experiencing. Mm. And so I wanted to specifically then research that. And I did qualitative study interviews with lawyers and judges and social workers. In that case, I didn't interview clients. I had used the client interviews from the prior study to ask them, you know, how housing came up in the trajectory of a child welfare case. And so sometimes it could be precipitating, right? I mean, a child welfare worker, you know, walks in, or there's someone that calls because there's an exposed electrical wire, or a child is, let's say, in a shelter and can't find a place to plug in whatever machines they need for their medical condition, or, you know, and that actually is what brings the family into the child welfare system in the first place, which to me just sort of seemed like a proxy for poverty. And then sometimes there are complications that arise during the life of a child welfare case. So, you know, kids are taken away from the mother because she is going into drug treatment. She goes into drug treatment and loses her public housing spot. Mm. And nobody actually thought about the housing, but had they thought about it ahead of time, well, maybe they could have arranged to have that spot held for her because she was actually complying with her family service plan. She was going into treatment in order to become a better parent. Now everybody's reunify and there's no place to go because she's lost her housing slot. Mm. So those kind of things came up as well. And I was interested in what were the decisions that the judges and the lawyers and the social workers were making, all faced with the same situation. Some of them were making decisions to keep families together, and some of them were saying, you know, because the law was kind of ambiguous. And also there are...
Is that part of the problem? Vagaries in the law?
And I'm not sure that that's a bad thing. I mean, I think we need to leave some, you know, something open to, you know, discretion. So that's part of the problem. And part of the problem also is sometimes the law is designed with... you know, laws come out as a process of compromise, and you know, they're designed with some conflicting mandates. So we are supposed to try. I mean, our federal laws say that we are supposed to try to keep families together or reunify them whenever possible. However, there's things like concurrent planning. Maybe at the same time, we're going to be working to look for an alternative family if it doesn't work. But then, if you have the same caseworker, how can they devote all of their resources if they have to be doing something else concurrently? We don't really have the same sort of financial supports for existing families that we do for foster families. So I might have a judge who would say to me, I'd love to, you know, order money for this family to fix their electrical wires because they have a two-year-old, but I can't. But I can give money to the foster family, you know. And so there's things that maybe nobody really thought of. When things play out on the ground, you see things that you didn't realize. Mm. And I think part of the problem is we don't have a feedback loop to change the policies when they need to be changed. And we also don't have, you know, we don't usually call child welfare workers to come testify and say, what would you like to see in the policy? And,
sure.
And we certainly almost never call parents in, you know, whose children have been taken away or people engaged in prostitution. If we did, we'd probably, you know, learn a lot more and hopefully have some better policies.
Speaking with Dr. Corey Shadema, an associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. She's speaking tonight at the University of Utah College of Social Work about social justice principles in the profession of social work. If you'd like to join us, we're talking about the intersection of law and social work and social justice. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to Luis calling from Murray. Luis, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks. Go right ahead.
I have a question. Interesting topic. I want to... I jump in and say, like, at what point or what age bracket do you think that people fall into the work of prostitution? Is it more at the juvenile court system, or is it more towards the now adult court system?
Good question, Luis. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. I know from my work with people in Baltimore and in Philadelphia that it generally starts, it really varies. But we do have a lot of people starting, you know, in their teen years. The people in both of those programs, they don't take anybody who is a minor, right, who's in the juvenile system. And my understanding in both places is that they tend not to arrest minors for engaging in prostitution. So they might arrest them for other things, for, you know, loitering, public indecency, other things, but they don't want to give them that label, and they have other means of, I think, trying to intervene. And it also raises sort of interesting questions. You know, if you have a statutory rape law, can you actually charge somebody with prostitution that can't consent to sex? So it does raise, I guess, a legal conundrum over there. The people in the programs that we're looking at range in age from 18 to mid-50s. And with most of them being in their 30s and their 40s. So the people in the programs that I'm seeing are, you know, generally that, I think it's about 34 is our average age for the people in those programs. When I do my interviews, a lot of them started when they were maybe 16. Some of them started when they were 12. You know, I have someone who told me, you know, mom and dad sent her out and said, you know, don't come back until you bring some money, and this is what you do. And her sister wrote down license plates. So we definitely have instances of that there. But I don't know the average age for the big group that I've seen. But
Luis, does that answer your question?
Yes. And just to let you know, I'm a student at the College of Social Work up at the University of Utah, so I just want to say thank you for coming over and talking to us.
Thanks. Maybe we'll see you tonight.
Thanks, Luis. I guess Luis's question kind of leads to this idea of intervening. If you have young kids who are engaging in these activities, how do you intervene? Are there some red flags where the system can kick in before they get to this selling their bodies?
Yeah. I'm not so much an expert on kind of the juvenile piece of prostitution. I do think our recent attention, and this is national, and it's certainly the case in Philadelphia and Baltimore, where I'm doing my research. There's a lot of attention now to trafficking and trafficking of minors. So being on the lookout, knowing what signs to look for, if you have anybody working with youth, so whether they're teachers or social workers or they're in the delinquency system or the dependency system, sort of knowing what signs to look for, what questions to ask. So I think the heightened attention to trafficking is really important. And this would be the case with anything troubling, right? If youth have a safe place to come and bring their concerns, are there adults, trusting adults that they could talk to? So, making schools places where kids feel not like they're being challenged and, can we provide opportunities? Think of school as a safe haven, for people. That could be something. And a lot of the things that we see with the women in the program, the individual stories, there are quite a lot of stories of childhood sexual abuse, family members, neighbors. And so I think being aware of that and of some of the really damaging consequences might be helpful in intervening in those situations. Because sometimes there's I've heard in some of my stories, a slippery slope, uncle so-and-so asked me to do this and gives me a dollar. And so I think sort of really thinking about, yes, this happens in families, this happens in neighborhoods, and we need to pay attention to it. We need to believe. If a child comes to us and said, this is happening to me, we need to believe them, take their word for it and investigate.
One thing that you mentioned was the lack of a feedback loop. I mean, there's just not a mechanism in place to get feedback from the front lines. How can the system change so that lawyers and judges and social workers hear more from their clients? How can the system change where judges can give their input and start to, give their observations on how the system can be improved?
Well, they can read my articles. that's one thing that I try and do. I try and actually provide a platform for some of these voices. I mean, clearly, when I interview somebody, I frame it and I'm mediating it. But, one of the hopes is that I'm making a contribution is by amplifying these voices or bringing them into. So doing, more research where we're talking to actual people. But, why couldn't we invite people to come and talk to us? I don't really see why it would be so hard, actually, to bring in a group of judges, bring in a group of police officers, bring in women who are engaged in prostitution.
So integrating that kind of practice into the culture of an organization and into government.
Exactly. And, I'm aware of the difficulties. I mean, I think we're talking to people who are highly stigmatized and maybe made to feel uncomfortable. So if we're going to do that, we have to think about how do we make this a welcoming place? How do we make it feel that people are not, being targeted? And so while I say it's easy, we could actually go out and seek voices. We'd also have to make sure that we really are interested. We're genuinely interested. And then we're not viewing, the people that we're talking to, we're not looking down on them, that we really do want their input, that we really do care. And so coming with a genuine interest is important. And I don't really see, any reason why we could not. People want to talk. I interview people. People say, oh, how do you get people to talk to you? I think people know when you're genuine. And if you open your heart to them and you open your mind and you want to listen to them, people have stories. And I think people want to tell them. I don't think there's a problem. I just don't think we're listening.
And I guess that is back to the core value of what social justice is respect. And are we as professionals, are we as a society embracing that principle enough?
I think that's a great question, and I'm not sure that we are. I mean, I really do think that, walk in my shoes for a day, I really think that would go a long way for better policies. Really trying to think, what does it feel like? I can't say, I don't think I could ever say I would never do X, whatever that X is. I can't say that, not having been through some of the situations that I hear about. And so really trying to understand people from their own perspective. Why do people do what they do? People usually have reasons for doing what they do. And I think a more socially just society would be one that listened more.
Dr. Corey Shadema, she's an associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. And Dr. Shadema, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Corey Shadema will deliver the lecture Storying the Social Justice Profession, Tales from the Field, tonight, October 18th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the University of Utah College of Social Work. That's 395 South, 1500 East in Salt Lake City on the University of Utah campus. You can find out more information at 801-581-8455, or you can follow the links on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, the artist Nancy Holt. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City.